Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll talk with Andrew Taylor, who's the author of Congress, A Performance Appraisal. I hope that you enjoy the interview.
Welcome to New Books in Political Science. I have the real good pleasure today of talking to Andrew Taylor, who is the author of Congress, A Performance Appraisal. Andy, how are you doing today?
Fine, thank you, Heath.
I really enjoyed the book, and before we get to talking about the book, maybe you can tell us just a little bit more about yourself, where you are, where you've been, what comes before this interesting book.
Well, as the listeners might have already noticed, I'm not a native of the United States. I'm from the United Kingdom originally, and I came over to the U.S. In the late 1980s as a graduate student. I was always interested in American politics, and my undergraduate major at the University of Kent at Canterbury in England was in American Studies with a concentration in American politics. And I came to the United States for a year, actually at Lehigh University, which is in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, as an undergraduate. When I was finishing my undergraduate degree in the UK, was at a loose end and was in contact with people like faculty at Lehigh, and they suggested why don't I come and do a master's, which I thought was a pretty good idea at the time, largely because I didn't have anything better to do, and then really wanted to go on, and so I did my master's there. I did my PhD at the University of Connecticut. And then had decided sort of halfway through that I wanted an academic career in the U.S. and I was working on American politics generally, specifically on Congress. The dissertation at UConn was actually on policy productivity under unified and divided government, sort of inspired somewhat by Mayhew's work at the time. But I considered myself primarily a congressional scholar, and then so I went out on the market once I got my PhD, and I came down here to NC State in Raleigh in 1995, and it's amazing to think it's been 18 years, but I've been here ever since.
Right, and you know, in this book, as we get to the end of our discussion, you can see, and I don't know if this is in your plan, applying the very same method to other countries and other legislatures, and so I enjoyed the book a lot. The way you set the book up at the start is you kind of take a survey of research and public perceptions on what's wrong with Congress.
Right.
And it seems to me that you're also, as you move in the book, you're thinking, well, some of this is right, some of this is wrong, some of this is just, you know, kind of the misperception. I wonder if just briefly we can start out with you kind of either talking a little bit about some of the sort of the best of that research that really gives us the best sense of either the public opinion about Congress or the best sense of what's wrong with Congress, but sort of sort out for us just our kind of these basic impressions from what we actually know about Congress.
Yeah, well, I, as most of the listeners probably know, Congress is not held in very high esteem by the American public, and all the survey research demonstrates that in both an absolute and relative sense, public approval of members of Congress, collectively, the job that the institution is doing, very low rates, basically all-time lows. You know, most of these data have been collected really since the late 1960s, early 1970s, but in that time span, we're at a very low level. Approval for the institution as a whole is in the high single digits. Sometimes in the last few years, it's got above that in the low doubles, you know, low teens, but it's terrible. But there is also, literature out there, books and articles written both by practitioners, journalists, and political scientists that kind of share this approach and are also equally disparaging of the Congress. And so what I wanted to do was at the beginning of the book is kind of set that up as a general position of both the public, but also political scientists, journalists, and practitioners. There's some interesting work done by former members of Congress along these lines, and say, look, people don't really think very highly of the United States Congress. Is this fair? Is this a legitimate position? It's obviously a clear one. Is it legitimate? And the thing that really sort of provoked this book was I would hear this all the time. Even when I was up in Washington, I was the American Political Science Association Congressional Fellow in 2000. I heard it up there all the time. People just assumed that Congress was terrible, but I'd never seen anybody who'd really sat down and try to work this out in a systematic way and suggest whether it was a fair assessment or not. So that's the first part of the book is laying that out, and that's really what kind of interested me in writing it.
Yeah, I think what's really appealing about the book is because is this, we've read it in so many different places, and the bemoaning of what's wrong with Congress, has created lots and lots of books and lots of articles. But, you take this approach where you're going to try to do something and make a little bit more sense of this, and your approach is to create a series of benchmarks. So how did you develop these benchmarks? What are they? They're based around 6 principles, and you end up with 37 benchmarks. So what was your approach to identifying these 37 and not 37 others, and why these 6 principles, and why not 6 other principles?
Yeah.
How did you build this base for the book?
Well, I was really interested in the sort of benchmarking approach. I thought that this was the best way to go about trying to make a strong case that Congress wasn't as bad as popular wisdom suggested it was. And so I thought to give that argument, well, initially to find out how well Congress had been performing in an objective sense, and then once I would have those results, be able to sell them to a obviously skeptical public in a compelling way, I realized I needed to go about this systematically and come up with certain metrics by which to measure congressional performance. And I was interested in the benchmarking approach. I had administration who used benchmarking quite a lot and felt that was a good way to go. The real trick was talking about Congress aspirations we have for congressional performance, which generally tend to be in the abstract, and then coming up with measures of them that could easily be used in a concrete sense. And so what I did was I started off at the more general and abstract end of that continuum and come up with what I, as you said, Heath, were 6 basic aspirations, and they come from all aspects of congressional life, and starting with how Congress represents the public, whether Congress is transparent and easily accessible by the public, then sort of how Congress operates. Does it work well? Does it have a good, does it deliberate? Does it debate in a good way? And then finally, talking about outcomes, and whether it makes effective policy or not. And finally, the 6th sort of aspiration is does it sort of play what we consider a healthy role in the system of separation of powers and checks and balances. So those are the basic sort of aspirations, and then I had to think of a way of, and by the way, those aspirations are kind of rooted basically in normative political theory, I guess you would say. These are sort of things that any people should want in a modern democracy of their legislative body. And then I try to, from those six basic aspirations, I went with a more concrete and narrow benchmark that would provide things that we could actually measure. And so we could say, yes, Congress has met or maybe exceeded or has not met, has not reached those particular benchmarks. And so the benchmarks are a lot more specific and tangible. And the benchmarks are rather like the aspirations, crafted from normative political theory, but also from the experiences of Congress in the past, which I think that is fair game to compare the Congress of today to the Congresses of the past, and also peer legislative bodies, which I consider those in the American space, those in such similar industrialized Congress. And so the benchmark was come from those, and the assessment of the benchmark comes from those things as well.
So we don't have enough time to go talk about each and every one of those 37, but I wonder if there was one of those benchmarks that surprised you about how well Congress scores, one that sort of sticks out to you. That's like Congress is really doing well. If we think about this as an important benchmark, Congress really scores quite highly on this.
Yeah, well, maybe I could talk about a couple of series of them, Heath. I mean, I think, you know, probably the two that would resonate most with members of the general public are the first benchmarks under the first basic aspiration, which I call a robust representative democracy. That is, does Congress represent the views of the American public? And, you know, Americans continue to find that that's not the case, that people are in a kind of cocoon up in Washington. They're disconnected from the everyday lives of the American people. They don't understand the sort of trials and tribulations of everyday life in the country. But if you look at least sort of rather coarse, but basic aggregate data, you can see that Congress moves to match changes in public opinion pretty well over time. And so that's an interesting benchmark, or a couple of benchmarks, I guess, of the 37 that are met, that I think many Americans might be surprised to know. At the other end of the sort of continuum is the outcome. So that's sort of input, I guess, is the outcome and that's effective public policy. And again, you know, the American public tends to think that Congress isn't very good at solving problems, but by the benchmark, Congress does pretty well. It certainly doesn't do so well in I argue in dealing with problems that are coming down the road. It's not very, doesn't look very well to the future. But I argue that it does a pretty good job. The U.S. has a robust economy. Many people across the world will tell you, this has been the last century, at least with an American century. Kinds of public policies in the government past. So I think that also would surprise many members of the American public that it meets or largely meets some of the policy benchmarks as well. So those two, I think, just because those are the two main labels leveled at the Congress by the American people, I think the findings there would be perhaps most surprising to the layperson who just picks up the book, not knowing not being a political scientist, not knowing a great deal about it.
Yeah, and when you go through the full list, you know, something like, I don't know if I didn't count up exactly, but it's something like a half or fully met, another third or so were somewhat met, and you get this other portion where Congress doesn't meet the principles or benchmarks or expectations really at all.
Where they're not met, are kind of interesting. Some of the process metrics, some of the process benchmarks, and how Congress operates. Not having significant or enough turnover of the membership. Members of Congress are not represented as the general public in an economic sense. They are much wealthier, even though that happens with religious affiliation, occupation, service, and military service. In other regards, they don't. So there are some significant ones where they don't meet that benchmark. They don't meet the benchmark. But you are right in describing the fact that the majority are met, at least half are exceeded, and the rest are half of the rest are met, getting somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4 of the benchmark being
Yeah, you end the book, not surprisingly, with some recommendations. Recommendations of maybe how to improve things.
Yeah.
Which of these recommendations do you think has the greatest likelihood of being enacted? Some of the recommendations you could imagine, well, this never will happen. It's a good idea, but it's not going to happen. Are there any that stand out to you? Is it something that actually that could be enacted? That there would be bipartisan support for it, and it would have a real beneficial impact on the institution?
Well, just immediately coming to mind, I just mentioned in answer to the previous question that some of the benchmarks that weren't met were ones that had to do with internal process and procedures. And one of the criticisms, because it doesn't meet a benchmark, it doesn't meet a sort of basic majoritarian benchmark, one of the procedures that gets criticism in the book is the notion of unlimited debate in the Senate, the rules that allow for unlimited debate and therefore the filibuster in the Senate. And, the news at the moment is full of at least full of be a real meaningful effort by the majority leadership in the Senate to clip the wings of the filibuster and change rules, particularly on confirmation of presidential nominees to executive and judicial positions, whether they will reduce the effect of the filibuster. And a lot of people are suggesting that could well happen. It might be painful for Senator Reid and the Senate Democrats to get that to happen, but it's on the cards. It might not be a bipartisan change, and you mentioned that in the question, assuming that any changes have to be bipartisan, but it might be on the cards, and it's one that immediately comes to mind that is sort of consistent with some of the things that I've said in the conclusion.
Yeah. Have you had the chance or have any members of Congress or former members of Congress had the chance to read the book? The book is very new.
I'm not sure, although a colleague of mine did say he had the book in his office when Representative Pete Sessions, who actually is now the chair of the House Rules Committee from Texas, came in and started picking up and reading it and sort of asking him who this Taylor fellow was. But other than that, no. It is, I should sort of fork it to them. One of the interesting footnotes, or endnotes in the book, I think is a sort of personal one, which is the very last endnote, because I kind of conclude, as this concerned by now, by talking about the number of benchmarks which I feel Congress has met, that listeners might have learned by now, that I'm kind of, not, this isn't a book full of praise for Congress, but it is a book that sort of defends Congress from the criticisms that we've been talking about. So I am sympathetic to Congress. I do suggest to Congress better than others. But this last footnote does talk a little bit about the members of Congress that I know and have known in the past. And it's written, the footnote itself is written to demonstrate that we should expect Congress to have some, because after all, members of Congress themselves are human beings, and human beings, as we know, are far from perfect. So I should actually contact some of these people from my present and past and ask them, as members of Congress, what they think of the book. I'm sure, my sense is that a lot of members would say that they might disagree with a lot of specifics, but would sort of say, look, you're right. The institution is unjustly vilified, and it's an institution, it's a normative sort of part of the argument here as well, Heath, that the institution, I think, is worth obviously protecting and promoting. And you can only do that if people buy into the idea that it's doing an okay-ish job. If you continue along the lines of vilifying it, and the public continues to believe it's doing a very, very poor job, members don't have a lot of promote the institution's interest, and it's only going to lose. So I would think a lot of members would sort of, they might not want to tell their constituents this because it's not a popular argument, but they might actually say, you're right, you know, the institution isn't doing as bad a job as a lot of people think.
You can see a public conversation about your book. You definitely see this incorporated into a undergraduate course. It's so naturally in the way in which I think students might be able to really grasp.
I wrote it for that, and my publisher wanted me to write it in that way. I don't know whether when I initially embarked on the project I would have wanted to write it quite like that. I foresaw it a little bit more as a kind of trade book, which may be used as a text, and I think it's now a textbook that may be sort of read as a trade book. But yeah, it's consciously broad. One reason, because if you're going to praise the performance of an institution, you should praise all of it. But also because it could be take the place of be the textbook in an undergraduate course on Congress. And so if you want to talk about elections, there's enough in there that allows you to talk about elections with your students. If you want to talk about policy outputs, there's enough there. If you want to talk about inter-branch relations, there's enough there. If you want to talk about procedure, there's enough there. So yes, it is consciously broad because I think we sort of envision it being used in undergraduate courses in Congress.
Yeah, I easily see that. So what is next for you? Do you have a new book project ahead, or a non-book but research project? What's the next thing on your research agenda?
I'm working on a number of. I actually wrote a book last year. But it came out last year in 2012. So this has a 2013 copyright, and that's a book that came out with the University of Michigan Press called "Exploring Congressional Life," which is aimed more at an academic audience. And so, with two books coming out in 2 years, I'm sort of exhaling a little bit. But I've been working on some article-length projects on Congress. I'm working on something on seniority in Congress. I'm working on something about the conditions under which members publicize their voting records to their constituents, and a number of other little projects. I am actually working on a book, but it's with a colleague in sociology on something completely unrelated to Congress. It's on school board politics in Wake County, North Carolina, interestingly enough, which have actually punctuated the national consciousness on occasions, and there's an interesting story to tell there. But as far as the next major project on Congress, I have been doing a little bit when I've had some time, and I want to accelerate this. I'm very interested in, and this is sort of connected with this performance appraisal book, I'm very interested in the kinds of members of Congress who are what, I guess, some congressional scholars, people like back in the 60s, people like Donald Matthews would call institutional patriots. That is, people who, members who are interested in protecting and promoting the interests of the institution as a whole. And obviously, I think that's a good thing. The premise of the project is that, you know, the incentives, there aren't incentives to do that. It doesn't really help you get re-elected, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, but there have been these characters over the course of congressional history. And so I've been doing some research and have had some graduate and undergraduate students assist me over the last couple of years creating a data set of who these people are, and we're trying to sort of, I'm trying to sort of explain why they do it and under what conditions do they express and act in a meaningful way, they act upon this sort of impulse of institutional patriotism. So it's in its very preliminary stages, but I think that's going to be the next big Congress project.
Yeah, well, I hope when that's done, or when the school board project book is done, you'll come back and talk about those books.
I'd be very happy to.
Yeah, until then, Andrew is the author of Congress of Performance Appraisal, published by Westview Press. Andy, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me here.